Okay, so welcome to today's tutorial in programming languages. We have had the MASIC protocol and the hardware model extended by caches, write buffers, and invalidate buffers as the reference lecture for that tutorial sheet. So I have thought that it would be a good idea to try to straighten up the idea of creating these protocol diagrams that we have had in the lecture. And for that, there's the first assignment on the new sheet, where we should take the example from the lecture and have a look at a certain execution that is associated with that, namely the one that you see in the assignment, which would be, first of all, B1 is executed, and then there's A1 executed, A2, then B1 and B2. So that is the instruction sequence that is fixed for our diagram this time. And then the second thing that we need in order to draw such a diagram is to fix the state of the memory and cache lines and all that at the start of the sequence that we are going to see. And for that, we see in the assignment that CPU B exclusively has A and B in its cache. Further on, we see that for the first happened before diagram, to kind of warm ourselves up, we have to draw a happened before diagram without any store and invalidate buffers. So it's a plain cache-based sequence diagram. So maybe let's start right from that. So what's the first thing that we need to do here? Or we need to somehow create the means for the diagram, in the sense that we need to establish the processes that we are gonna let communicate afterwards. So what do we need for that? We need the a process line for CPU A and one for CPU B. Okay. And then what else is there? Well, we have two variables, A and B, for which are accessed from both of the processes, and both of them have or reside in the cache. So there's local copies of each of them. So let's also add those. This is now the A and B, A and B, and we have cache lines A and B over here, and cache lines A and B, like that. So that's the kind of initial thing for our graph. Now we need to establish the initial state that everything has. Let's do that. And for that, we know that CPU B exclusively has A and B in its cache. There is no initial value for them given here, but we can take them from over here. So it's initially zero for the same thing. Exclusive. Zero, exclusive, zero, and invalid over here. Then there is executions B1, A2, B2. So what do I have to do now? The thing is that this is kind of a global order of the instructions. So what I need to do is I need to kind of distribute them over the space that I have in this diagram, starting from the first one to up until the last. And I have to assign them to the correct process lines, of course. So that's what I'm going to do. B1 is the check for the value of B. So that's going to be the first thing. Then we have A1. A1 is going to be the assignment A1. Then there's A2, which is the assignment to B. Then there's once again the check. B is 0 over here, and then we have the second check. Okay, so we can start now with actually drawing the lines. So what's going to happen at first? Oh, yeah. This has been another semester where we had... Let's move that away so that I can't accidentally do something like that again. Good. But anyway, as soon as we have entered the sequence in the process diagram, we are kind of independent of the slides anyway. Setup. So. Okay. So, you want to start with CPU-B, that's correct. That's the first instruction that's gonna start. And it's going to try to do what? Okay, so it's going to communicate with this one first. Okay, and now what's gonna happen here? Well, we have to sorry, I was misleading. Maybe we wanted to answer first. So from cache, these names of the messages, I haven't given names to the ones that are kind of locally for one CPU. So you mean the right thing, of course. There's going to be a response from the cache line direct, but the ones that are communicating between the process and its own cache, I haven't given any names so far. So. That's just an anonymous answer back. So, no. Just an anonymous answer back, and this will be. Oh no. Oof. That was not intended. Of course, there should be the other line. So, there's going to be an answer back, and we're going to get the evaluation for that, and that's all. Good. So, we're next in row. Well, it's pretty easy. You just have to follow the sequence. So that one is the one that we're gonna. A is one. So what do we have to do for that? This is an. So you already helped, yeah. So the read invalidate is the idea, because we're going to do an assignment, and for that, well, before we we put out any real message out there. First thing we're going to check is, well, we want to somehow access A. So let's look up what the state of the whole thing is before we actually decide. So there's the first dependency on this one here. And as it is invalid in there, we need to... Well, we need to somehow get a value for that. For that, we need to issue a read message. And since we are gonna write to the variable immediately, what we're gonna do is we're gonna do a read and invalidate in one piece. And yeah, that's gonna go out there. So this will be read and invalidate in one piece. And yeah, since we have a cache line that keeps track of A already, we also know who receives that thing, and that will be this one over here. So that's going to reach this thing at some point in time. We're going to answer the read request with a read response. So that that's be on the bus right there. That's a read response. And, well, it's going to reach the original target, this one over here. That, and from that point on, we're gonna have to switch states, because we have provided information about one thing that we thought we would have exclusively so far. So what we're gonna do is we're gonna set that to shared zero, and this will also be shared zero from then on. So there's still one thing we still have to invalidate, the process A has to be sure that the others have invalidated before it can actually override the value. So for that, we will have to do the communication between those two. So this is going to be an invalidate acknowledgement, and that also modifies the state of the caches. So here, yeah, that's invalid now, and this one here will immediately go over to be modified, in this case one, because that's what we're having here. Okay, so now that we have performed our action, we can connect this thing back up. Good. So let's do the next one, which is also an assignment. So yeah, first of all, give it a few events before and after. And there's communication involved with B, so we have to check the line for B, the cache line for B. And yeah, that's the first thing that we're going to do. So let's connect this one. And here maybe also the same thing. So it's kind of the symmetric case. It's also invalid there, and it's exclusive there, so we need to perform the whole thing once again. So let's do that all in one. So we have communication over here. It needs three dots, then it will communicate back there, and then there's the other event already there. And we're going to have read invalid and invalidate in one go. Then there will be the read response, and then there's gonna be the invalidate acknowledgement. We will have read response and invalidate acknowledgement. Then there's cache state changes to shared 0 and invalid, and shared 0 and modified 1. And we have to reconnect those. So far it's just a plain copy of the thing that we already had. So let's move on to the next thing, which is now a little bit different, although we already have seen a check happening, but it was on other cache states. So there might be something different going on. First of all, we need to communicate with the cache line over here. So that's still the same. Goes over here. But now the question is, it's an invalid. What do we have to do there then? Well, we have seen a similar thing already for the writes. We have to... Yeah. So we have to communicate. Of course, we don't know that we will directly address the cache of B. We could also communicate with the memory. So we will just throw out our message over here, which will, in this case, just be a read request at that point. And well, that will gonna reach the it's gonna reach the B over here, where we have the modified version of the B line here. And yeah, what's gonna happen now? At some point, we're gonna react to that. Read response? So why is it a write back? Yeah, because if it would go to just a shared, we couldn't differentiate between the thing being modified or not, so we need to inform the memory about a change that has been going on. And that's what we do with the write back. So that's what we're going to do. We're going to issue a write back, which will at some point reach the cache line here. And we can assume now that we have a shared value of 1, which doesn't need to be modified anymore because we have informed the memory. And we're going to have a shared 1 here. Add this thing and draw the line. Good. And for the other part, well... Again, it's just the same thing over here. We have a similar situation as before. We have the invalid state, and thus we have to communicate with someone, which will be process A, set a read request, and a write back. In principle, if we had the line for memory in there, something like that, then the write backs, of course, would also have, well, it's not so easy, like something like this, where we would reach the memory. One dot, well, you mean events when we win it? Probably. And
why do we have only one cache event in process A and cache B? It's a shared value instead of two. One shared, one would be found.
You would propose to have another event in there, you say?
Yes.
Like that? Well, You could kind of separate them if you would like to kind of defer the sending of the message somehow. That's a kind of granularity that I have not really specified.
Okay, so it doesn't
matter. That much. Well, if you process it immediately, then it goes over to Shared and sends out its message. It's a matter of how detailed you are in modeling and whether there is actually, whether you want to stress that there is a delay going on in there. It's a matter of modeling. But the only thing is that over here we do it a little bit differently because we have two switches going on there. At first, there's switching from exclusive to shared, and then we switch once again to invalid. So that's why we we could have merged these things. Maybe that would have been okay. There's no switch in states going on. If you just choose different events, then that may have been something with the timing when these things are actually sent, but that's not so important for the cache states. Okay. Yes?
I have a general question. When do we ever get to the state where cache line has an exclusive state? When it's not in the beginning?
When
because we only read and then it's shared. It's modified, but we never reach an exclusive state again because we just call the write back state and
that's a good question, and the answer would be that if you start from a system where there are several cores and several caches, but none of them has information about the cache line in question, then everything's invalid, of course, but there's still the memory who has information about that. And exclusive is the state that you get when you issue a read request, and none of the other caches answers, but instead the memory answers. So it's a little bit simplified here, but the messages also carry with them who issued them. So you can detect when the memory was answering you, and then it's...
Yeah, so in this model, we can not queue, but when we can address the main memory...
Well, you would have to draw this memory line, of course, and would be one that wouldn't carry any state information because it's not part of the MESI thing, but there might be something like a write queue and that... Yeah, the thing is... And there must have been preceding some communication where A and B has already been loaded, otherwise you wouldn't have the exclusive lines in there. So, the lines are you could imagine them to be longer than that, and there's been preceding communication going on. So that's what we have with this initial values. That just makes life easier for us. We just don't have to draw these initial values. Okay. So I hope that was easy for you, because that was the simple model without these buffers. Apart from that, is there any questions on setting up such a diagram and starting to draw the messages and all that? Because that, of course, is something that you can do very well with pen and paper, and might be something that you encounter later on once again. Okay, good. So, then let's move on. We have... The next thing is draw happened before diagram for the Decker algorithm, describing an interaction of two threads for a case where one of the threads succeeds to enter the critical section. Assume the hardware to be sequentially consistent. In the beginning, all variables have a value of zero and are in shared state. Okay, that sounds like a new diagram. And also, we need to have a look at Decker, I suppose, because
I can't remember it from memory. So that would be
the Decker algorithm. Let's maybe try to decipher what's actually hidden in that assignment. So the questions would be, what is the machine model that we have to assume for our diagram, because that determines how many process lines we actually have to draw. So what would you say? Well, the only thing, well, I don't know whether each of you has the sheet. Okay. Well, it says in there, assume the hardware to be sequentially consistent. So first of all, we need to think about what hardware model is actually sequentially consistent. And yeah, well, the thing that breaks sequential consistency, well, that's the write and invalidate buffers. So that's something that the hardware should not have in order to be sequentially consistent. So it's just plain caches that are allowed in there. So far, so good. And yeah, the next thing is before in the assignment one, we had a given sequence of instructions that we could just annotate to the process lines. Over here, it's not so simple anymore, but maybe let's just start with, well, we have P0 and P1 as the two partners that are in crime, that are communicating. So we give them thread 0 and thread 1, and each of them should have a process line. So they are communicating with each other. Yeah, then the next thing that we see is, well, the shared variables that we're going to see in that is flag 0 and flag 1, which are both different different addresses in memory. And then there's the slot for the turn flag, which is also a different position in memory. So we have three lines in our caches. So let's introduce them. It's flag 0, flag 1, and the turn thing. Symmetrically over here, turn thing F1 and F0. And each of them gonna have a line. And we have the initial values. All variables have a value of 0 and are in shared state. So, shared 0, shared 0, shared 0. Good. Now we have to think of a sequence of instructions that reach the critical section of either of the threads. So, yeah, well, there's a lot of choice in there, but what would you say? What would you do in that situation?
Well,
So we need at least one of them. I just arbitrarily choose P0 to reach this point. So we have to somehow go back through the algorithm, and when there's choice, we have to kind of forge it the way that the choice will be in our favor. And with that, we're gonna take certain preconditions with us. So, in order to mouse always tends to disappear. In order to reach that point, what do we have to have? We need the while over here to terminate. So there needs to be flag one as being false. And what? Sorry?
We have to have flag one to be false or flag zero to be false.
Sorry, I didn't
know. We have to have flag one to be false, and at P1 we have to have flag zero.
Flag zero. What should flag zero have to be?
At P1 we have to have flag zero to be false to terminate the
UI. That's right. That would lead both of them into the critical section, which should be, well, we could expect that if we had that, there should be some things that would not be possible, like probably the flag would have to be, the turn would be somehow disjunct. So you couldn't just assume that the turn would be at one point the same as the other. So or maybe the flag setting from P1 would assure that the other process could not enter. So both of them won't be in the critical section at the same time. But there might be at least the chance for one of them to enter the critical section. Well, it's the purpose of the whole thing. So maybe let's try to go through that thing in a kind of destination-oriented way. So P0, flag one, flag zero, and will be assigned to true anyway. So we need to pass this instruction at any cost. So that would be the thing that we for sure want to have. So I will temporarily annotate these things on there. So in thread zero, we need to pass flag zero is true. So flag zero is true. Well, what is true in code? Well, one. So that is one we have to pass anyway. And then
next thing, in order to reach the critical section,
would be that we would have to,
the flag must evaluate to false
in order for us to fall through to the critical section. So for that, flag one is of interest, and as this will be kind of the last thing before we reach that, I'm going to annotate it over here. Flag one is in that case, it needs to be false, I guess. So for that, false is zero. Zero. Okay. So, what else is there for thread one? We
could in that case Yeah, that would be feasible when
there can be.
Yeah, I think that is a pretty smart way to reach the critical section, however, also a pretty boring one.
Okay, so with that you would have kind of an easy way to pass the whole thing. Let's maybe make...
How do you write on deck one ecosystem zero?
That's what...
It has to be zero to leave the wild, if I understand that, but why do you write zero and not the code that you execute?
The action really changes if it's one.
Well, yeah, but okay, we can remove that. That's what we actually check,
isn't it? Yeah, we check
whether it's true. But yeah, that was kind of yeah. That is the actual thing that's happening. But yeah, so that is kind of pretty boring. So that was not on purpose. So let's choose something a little bit different that also reaches the whole thing. So let's do something different over here. Maybe let's the thread one also pass the first instruction, and that's in this case F1 is 1. And now they both have kind of flagged that they have an interest to enter the critical section. So it's now maybe a little bit more interesting in there. So yeah, for that, what would you next do? We would
maybe let's choose P1 to progress a little further
and let it check the flag 0 for, well, you say we have to check for true, that's right. So let's do it like this. And no. Good, we have flag the check now, and well, in our case, flag 0 is not 1 but 0, so we can. Is actually 1, so we enter the loop. So next we have to check the turn for 1. So for whether it is 1 or not. And yeah, turn is still 0. In our case, so we can deflag, and now let's as the space runs out, let's maybe let the scheduler decide that the other or the timing decide that the other core is continuing. It also tries to access, in this case, critical section by trying to enter the loop and checking for whether that P1 is true. And, well, T1 has been set to 0 before, so now we will have reached the critical section. So. Yeah, there's not enough space there anymore, so let's just mark it with scribble. So that was the goal. Here we reached the critical section. So now we have something a little bit more interesting and can see what's actually happening in there. Good. So just having no interleaving of both of them, of course, will lead to the critical section. But yeah. that just isn't an interesting interleaving. So let's do a little more interesting interleaving. And yeah, let's proceed with our thing. First event is before the first thing. So we will set F0 to 1. It's an event F0 over here. That's always the first thing. No. And yeah, we have a shared value of 0 here. So what's the way to react to that? Sorry? Read and validate. You also have an idea? So now we have three ideas of what might actually be happening. In validation, we are all clear that that should happen because we're going to write to that, aren't we? So invalidation will be necessary, especially as we already know that there's the value is shared over there. So we have to inform the other one. So invalidation will be necessary. You said read would be necessary. You backed that up with the cache line thing. So that's a good thing to bring up there because.
Because actually probably the whole cache map is shared, so we have the rest of the memory already copied.
That's the thing. The state is for the whole cache line and not only for the variable. So, yeah. But in principle, the idea of thinking with that cache line model in mind is not bad. Especially that's the motivation for having this. If you have an invalid cache line that you need to read beforehand, so that's a good thing to keep in mind. However, for that case, the flag is for the whole cache line, so we don't need to read beforehand. We already have the information here, so we can just put out the invalidation message here. So let's do that. We invalidate, and since we know that the other one also carries the value as shared, we can simply draw the event over here and connect them with the invalidation, and well, that will probably just answer with the invalidation acknowledgement, because that's the only thing that that it can do. This will lead to a change in the cache state. This will be now invalid. Don't forget about the invalidation acknowledged message text, and then we have the modified one state over here, and this will then just connect over here. Good. So far so good. Let's progress. Yeah. An assignment to F1 is 1. That's going to communicate with F1 and has a definite end. It's a shared thing, so it's kind of the same procedure as before. We have F1 over here, so this is going to contribute with one partner. We will have the dependencies over here. We will have the invalidation messages going on like this, and we have changes in the cache lines which will be invalid and modified one like this. Same thing as before. Good. Then let's move on to the test. Check for check F0 for being 1 or not, and then there's a definite end event over there. We have to communicate with the cache line for F0, so that's what we're going to connect first. What's the state? We can read it from before. It's invalid. So in order to test, with either memory or the other process, this one doesn't know, but we know that the other one carries the F0 value, so this will be the event to go for, and with that we will issue, and we will reach an event over here at some point. Now, what's the message type? Read is what you say. Okay. So read and good. What's the response? Okay. So why is that? Well, that's. We have modified, and I should maybe repeat. So the thing is, we have a write back because there is this cache state of modified there, and we have to inform our peers about the actual value. So we can go over to shared once again, but we need to communicate with memory in order to make sure that our update doesn't get lost as soon as scheduling of the cache controller decides to evict the cache line for F0 at one point. So we will get a shared one over here, which can then be communicated back there. So, next one. We check for T. Yeah. Let's do that. We have to communicate with T. This is a local thing. That the turn variable is just locally present, so we can directly check and see that there's 0 in there, so there's no state change involved. So the next thing is to modify F1. So we have to communicate with F1. Now it's a little bit different than before, because we had a modification to F1 already, but back then it was shared. Now it's in state modified.
Yeah. I think it can directly be 1.0, because no other cache line has this value, as they are embedded, so we don't have to.
Exactly. We have modified, which is kind of an extended version of exclusive. And with that, we can just do our modification locally, and we're done with that. So there's no other communication involved. Good. The last one that's going to have to be checked is the read of F1. And F1, we see, is in our case, invalid is the one. So we are going to have to communicate with either memory or the other thread. And turns out that the other thread has information about that. So we're going to connect over there, and then over there. These are the easy ones. Then if we have invalid as value over here, we need to issue a read, because we just want to check. So that's just an easy read, which will reach cache line over here, which is modified 0. So we have a similar thing as that one over here. We will just answer, but not with a read response, but with a write back, because we are in modified state, and we can now switch over to shared 0 and shared 0, and we're done. Okay, so there's a few other interleavings that we have seen here. Very well. So, good. On a sequentially consistent machine, it seems to be pretty plausible that such a thing can happen. There's no circling there. It's just plain communication between the caches. Good. So, what's the next thing that we should do? Okay, now there's two threads A and B, executing A and B. And both of them access shared variables A and B. Process A writes one into variable B. Process B writes one into variable A. And apart from that, both read the respective other variable. Okay. So the question is now, we should devise a configuration of the underlying machine model such that the sequence of instructions reaching the respective program points after that thing lead to both the variables reg A and reg B containing the variable 0. Okay. For those who don't have the the sheet, let's maybe start with the drawing and annotate the instructions. There's no loops involved, so we just know the local sequence of instructions for both of them. So we have for A it is B goes to 1, and kind of a read of A into a local register A or something. So that's going to happen for A, and for B we're going to see A is 1 and the register B where variant is B. So these are the instructions. And these, the ones prefixed with reg are the local ones that the other one can't see. So that doesn't need to be communicated on the cache, between the caches. Good. Then we have caches for sure. Thus I will introduce cache lines for that. So we have a view on A and B, on both of them. And the one thing that is given is that the state that we want to reach after here should be the one where reg A and reg B, both of them contain value 0. So maybe, well, we can also introduce this reg A and reg B as lines. And what we should be doing is make sure that for either of them we have the value zero at that point. And we should try to come up with a way of making sure that this happens. Okay. The original text says devise a configuration of the underlying machine model such that a sequence of instructions reaching the points after the red line, so that the variables both have value zero. So the only thing that we can vary here is the machine model. So we have to come up with features of the machine that will help us in reaching state where reg A and reg B are zero.
You would need a store buffer, so if A writes to variable B, it writes to the store buffer, and then thread B wants to read a variable, but it does not move the store buffer.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so the idea would be to introduce another component, which would be the store buffer, in order to delay the stores of that are happening in there, so that we have still the chance of reading the outdated value from our local cache configurations. Good. So let's introduce such a store buffer, which is yet another line. Store buffer. Good. Then we have to come up with initial values. There are none of them, or initial states even. There's none given in the text. Well, zero. Okay. That's one thing. The variables are initially zero, so that is for sure. Reg A and reg B are kind of invalid anyway. There's no, they're not alive at that point. They're just created throughout the program. And the store buffers, well, are probably empty lists. And there, and yes, please. Is that an arbitrary choice, or is there an intention behind that?
No, there is the intention that it would fail immediately after we enter the second line of the code for each thread.
But why is shared state helpful there?
Because if we store the first statement in our store buffer and don't use an SFence instruction or something like that, it will never reach the other thread, but the other thread will still think it would be in a shared state.
So in order to get these effects of having outdated information, we need to have actual information in the first place. And that's what we want to do with shared. Okay. So yeah, that's the idea. So in order to see an effect of the store buffer, we need to distribute information before, and that's what we're going to do with shared state. There's nothing given about the state of the cache beforehand. We just have to come up with a configuration of our machine. So let's just assume that the initial state is shared for that. Good. So then, Wow. Yeah, we are gonna write to one of the variables. So, first of all, we maybe try to look up in our cache what the information is in there. If we have an exclusively distribute well. An exclusive version of our cache line. We don't need to access anything else. But yeah, looks like that's not what we are going to find here. So we have shared. With that, we need to issue invalidate message over there, or well, invalidate. Will somehow happen in some place, but with store buffers, we have the value already here, so we want to modify that, but the store won't immediately happen in there, so we don't need to issue the invalidate right now. We can just continue with working and just enter the whole thing into the store buffer. So we will communicate with the store buffer like that, which will lead to immediate response. Over here, and change of the state of the store buffer. We will carry the B goes to 1 in the store buffer. And with that, we can then answer that thing without changing the state over here. One thing I've omitted now in storytelling, well, when we have been over here, we might have had to check in the store buffer beforehand whether there is already a historical change to the cache line in there. So yeah, that's what I omitted. That would have to happen. Good. It's pretty similar on the other side. So here we have to communicate with, I think it's A. A will communicate with the store buffer. And like that. And we will have a change in the state of the store buffer.
Good.
Then the next thing is going to be thing over here where we access the A, and right now A is just a shared value which we're going to read. Locally, in order to be locally sequentially consistent, we would then, instead of just assuming that the thing is shared, we would need to communicate with the store buffer whether there is a pending write in there to address of A. Store buffer doesn't contain anything like that, so it just doesn't contribute any other thing in there, so this remains shared, and just somehow goes over here. Sorry?
You just want to write A,
Yeah, we should also write to register. Yeah, that's right. You're correct. So that is an example for an instruction that has several subcomponents, and you got me there. I missed the second part of that, which would mean that before actually ending that, we would have to write to reg A over there. So we would access this thing, and for that we would have to do read invalidate. With intention to write, and this doesn't go to the other core. It just has no information about that, so we know that there's someone else involved in that, which is the memory, which will at some point give the appropriate answer. Well, no, not like this, but more like this, the read response, and also, well, I think it also should give the invalidation acknowledge. Yeah. And then we can finally perform that and have our state change to, well, in that case, I don't know what that would be. That would depend on what the memory model says there, and it could be something random. So it doesn't necessarily need to be invalid here, but in principle, well, it's even wrong to assume that the cache state would be. It would be even wrong to assume that the cache state would be invalid, but it's merely the value that would be invalid, or something random, or depending on what the specification of the language actually says for uninitialized memory. And well, let's assume that it is just zero. So it's now exclusive zero. That would be the correct thing, because it's the exclude. Sorry? And then it's modified. And with the modified zero, yeah, well, yeah, that's just because we have written there, and we can't assume that. We didn't check what is there before. We just issued a write command, and if it's overwrites, it's still modified, although it's the same value as it had been before. That's a little bit critical here. That's completely dependent on the language specification, and let's just say it gives you zero if it is uninitialized. Yeah. That would need to be if we need to communicate with the other cores. Also, the initial idea when I devised that was that we wouldn't keep the thing in memory anyway, but in a register, and then the whole cache line thing doesn't apply anyway. So it's just, well, we have ignored that fact that would have been a register variable in my plan, but that would be the communication that would arise if we had that memory based.
Yes. The store buffer is empty.
The store buffer is still B1. Well, it's completely. Well, it's you cannot foresee when that thing will gonna fire and be emptied. So that's actually the exact reason why we can observe the the zero over here and over here. Because if perchance the store buffer decides not to to communicate the store via invalidate, then yeah, the outdated value will gonna remain in the cache of the other processor, and yeah, can still be assumed to be shared, and yeah, that's what's happening. Yeah, I forgot about that one. So that's why we have the zero still here as the state. Otherwise, the modification over here would have had to somehow, at some point, communicate with that one, with an invalidation message. But since that hasn't been at that point of time, it's still considered as being shared. Of course, there might come some point in the timeline where there is actual communication happening, like for example over here, where then the store buffer is empty, and we have an invalidation over here. But yeah, that in order to force a situation where we have zero still hanging around in the caches, we need to defer that message by God interaction or whatever. But yeah, that's what you might see in these programs. Whew. Okay, so still any questions on that? Good. So, let's move on to something else. Have you tried to do the coding piece for chance at home? Were you able to actually see that with a plain Decker implementation without any further instrumentation that you get arrays? I think it wasn't directly in the... it was there. There was this Decker's algorithm without memory barriers. Have you succeeded in the second part? Could you show that there's such a thing? Like,
yes, without any memory barriers, the code failed like 1/4 of the times. With memory barriers, succeeded all the time.
The others, was there someone who wasn't able to see the effect without memory barriers? Or, well, has anyone else tried? You said you've tried. Okay. Well, these effects are, I would say more spectacular if you try to implement these things yourself anyway. But, yeah. You can... Now that there's already so much time gone, not sure how far we will progress into these things, but we can just have a try. Okay. So there's a kind of a frame needed for the whole thing, which is this all these includes. So we need a header for being able to access the threading library of C. Thread H. looks like that is something which is probably quite quite a lot to do here. So maybe let's get ourselves the things from C over here and remove the parts that are in kind of the solution. So I think that is the, well, at least pretty much the thing that's given on the sheet. So we have libraries that gives us the environment. We say, well, I have a two-core machine, so that's why I preset this constant as two. Then I want to use true and false throughout my program, and yeah. The main thing, I think, is, well, it's just the same as we had before. The flags need to be initialized, but for that I also need to define them at some point as global variables where I have access to. So let's do so. Then else do I need? I need a turn, and I need some data that I'm gonna modify throughout my critical section in order to somehow show anything particularly interesting in there. So, yeah, and
if you look back to the Decker algorithm, I need to initialize my flags 0 and 1.
And I also need to somehow set the turn variable with something meaningful. So let's do so also. Good. What else is there? We will just here iterate through the number of threads and at some point create a pthread, and I'm gonna call a function Decker here which will implement that thing that we see on the slide, and that's already it. Okay, so far so good. Let's come up with such a method. So in pthreads, what you're supposed to do is you are supposed to provide a function where that gets a void pointer as return value and a void pointer that contains the thread ID as parameter. Okay, so that is the thing that's going to be given over to the pthread and executed in parallel. Good. So first of all, let's maybe obtain the thread ID.
We're going to use that as the variable value that is going to vary throughout the two communicating threads. So that's going to be the blue fields in the Decker algorithm over here.
So yeah, that's what we need that for. Good. So let's inform the public about who I am. laptop keyboards, everyone. Okay. So, and now we can start with implementing the actual algorithm. So, in order to show an effect of a Decker, we will probably want to execute the code several times. So, I'm gonna do my beloved while loop over here, and let's start right on. We will have flag of either ourselves or anyone else, like that, flag TID being true, so we signal our interest that the current thread TID wants to enter the critical section. Start actually from there. Then we need a while loop where we check for the interest of the peer, whether it will it wants to access the. Why is that happening? Whether it wants to access critical section, and we do so by checking, of course, whether it's true. And we can access the other's ID with one minus ourselves because we only have two peers over there. So that's also why the numthreads is only two. With that, we will have this conversion between the thread IDs working. Okay, so with that, we can enter in there. We just need the if check, whether it's actually our turn. So that is the variable that we are racing on. The turn ID needs to be TID. If not, then bad things gonna happen. We have we have to retreat and flag that we don't have an interest anymore to enter the critical section. So what we're gonna do is we will just busy wait on the turn variable. And in the end, when terminated with that, we can re-establish our claim on the flag. And I think with that, we're probably done. I don't know whether I've counted all the... Probably once again. And in between there, I think here we have the critical section where we can actually perform some work, and only after we can then give the turn to our peer and deflag. So, that would be it. I think as the others are already storming the lecture room, and that the outfitting the algorithm with barriers now is a little bit too much for the remaining 5 minutes, you can find that on the solution sheet that I'm going to put online. But that would be the way to implement that. With that algorithm, you should be able to observe the race yourself and be able to patch it with memory barriers, and you'll see how that is on the solution sheet. So thank you for your attention, and if it turns out to be unclear, don't refrain from writing an email or just stop by and ask a question. Thank you.